Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Dispatches. In the original Dispatches edition, Walter Fordham and myself spent some time talking about where this show came from and his inspiration to have some way to maybe debrief the Sangha somehow so we could all talk about our experience of serving Trungpa Rinpoche in the past and now, and his sense of wanting to make sure that the chronicles were actually something that went beyond looking back, and we could talk about how we're actually living the vision of Trungpa Rinpoche today. And it was quite coincidental that I had just come back from being in Garrison Institute in New York. The Dalai Lama had sponsored a conference called Dharma in the Americas. And the way that the conference was held in terms of format is that the main students of many of the teachers that were there actually gave presentations of representing their teachers. And as far as Sakyamuni Rinpoche, it was Judy Leaf and Josh, I can't remember Josh's last name, who actually takes care of the Sakyam. And in terms of, for example, Pondar Rinpoche with Steve Seeley, and it was very interesting to see the older students of many, many teachers actually had been originally Trungpa Rinpoche students, and I had a sense that this cannot be a mistake or a failing of Shambhala at all, that there is some way to continue one's service to the lineage and our relationship to Trungpa Rinpoche, perhaps within the Shambhala Mandala and in some cases outside of it, and all versions in between. There are many people who actually hold a seat in both mandalas. The first person I ever spoke to about this sense of a bigger Shambhala, a big tent full of little vajra pegs, little diamond pegs, was actually Helen Berliner. And Helen Berliner is here with me today. Welcome, Helen. And I'm delighted that after nearly, I think, a year and a half, we're finally getting to talk about this subject. So welcome to
Thank you.
Studio One.
I'm really happy to be here, and I'm happy to continue this conversation that we started low those many months ago.
As you know, we always organize this show in sort of two parts. The first one is when I asked you a little bit about the nature of your relationship to Trungpa Rinpoche, and then we take it to the next step, which is how are you actually serving that vision today? How did you meet Trungpa Rinpoche? When did you start? How did it evolve? Tell us.
How did I meet Trungpa Rinpoche? My connection was through Timothy Leary. So you know you're talking to an old hippie here. I actually had a very dear friend who married Timothy Leary. She went on a world tour. Have I told you this story?
No.
As she went on a world tour. One day she got bored. We were living in the Hamptons. And one day she said, you know, I just feel the need to travel. And she decided she was going to go around the world and wound up in Europe, where Leary was living at the time, in Switzerland. I get a phone call in the middle of the night. You must pack your bags. You must come. We're in Switzerland. I'm married. And coincidentally, I had applied to the Jung Institute in Zurich, and they were living outside of Zurich, and had been accepted. And to make a long story short, I went over there, and it was all a disaster, and I was back within a week. It was a very funny, kind of disastrous, chaotic time. I've since heard that the Jung Institute really went through a down period, and I think I hit the nadir, but and it has since rebounded. But at the time, it was pretty bad. And so I came back. However, Timothy Leary had given me a message to give to Allen Ginsberg. And so, this is a really long story, isn't it? When I got back, a friend said, oh, Ginsberg's going to be on television tonight. And this was the educational channel, Channel 13 in New York. So I tuned in. I just thought, well, he's, you know, I've got to make connection with him. I'll watch him on TV. And he was on this panel. I'll never forget it. It was a kind of a horse-shaped little arrangement panel of people, including the Living Theater people, Julian Beck, Julia Messina, Peter Orlovsky, Allen Ginsberg. And then there was this short, fat little Tibetan person. Nobody knew who this person was. He had obviously come along with Allen Ginsberg, but the television crew was not interested in this short Tibetan person who was in a Western suit and kept panning past for a half hour or an hour, however long the show was. It would pan to all these famous faces, you know, one face after another, and they'd all have their say. This person said nothing, and they kept panning past, back and forth, till the very, like, last 2 minutes of the show, and as the camera was about to pan yet again past him, the person turned toward the cameraman. And I don't know any other kind of updated way to put it. He zapped the camera, and the guy couldn't move. I mean, he just stayed put till the end of the show. He couldn't move. That's the way the show ended, and that's where the credits appeared, with Drunpa Rinpoche's face just straight on the cameraman and the camera straight on him. And it stayed like that. And I mean, I was with a friend, and I said, my goodness, what was that? And my friend said, I don't know. I don't know.
Somebody's in control.
But in any case, that was Drunpa Rinpoche. It was the first time I had ever laid eyes on him. Someone else in the room said, oh, that's that Tibetan lama who has a place. I think he's staying up in Vermont somewhere. And, we decided that was a pretty interesting experience. And the following weekend, hopped in a car and went up to the first seminar that Drunpa Rinpoche ever taught in the U.S. And I just remember that afterwards, nobody knew what he was talking about. He was teaching in a very traditional fashion, you know, with the text, turning the pages of the text, and then basically translating on the spot into English. And we all ran up to the house where those people had a collection of Christmas Humphreys and Blofeld books, and you know, hit the glossaries to try and find out
what he was talking about.
What was going on? But and you know, it was such that situation with the television show. It was so powerful. I told that story to somebody years and years ago. You know, I was just relating how powerful that moment. It was just stopped time and space. I mean, relating it to someone, and he said, this was Charlie Rokozak in New York, and he said, oh yeah, I took a picture of it. And he had. And that's how long it lasted. He took a picture of it, and he gave me the picture.
It's interesting, because I actually think that perhaps those are the moments that we consider sort of the smell of fresh meat, yeah, that we tend to follow in our path. Drunpa Rinpoche used to talk about tiger cubs smelling fresh meat.
Right.
And those are the moments that probably take us through the continuity of our path.
That's right. Oh, that is so right. And it's like that once you've tasted that meat, you know, once you've gotten a whiff of that, you can't not follow that, you know. And I think that that's what's taken a lot of us, older students of Drunpa Rinpoche, wherever we may have gone. During the time that he was teaching and ever since.
Well, in your case in particular, you have definitely eaten some very large chunks of beef in your path. You worked a lot with Drunpa Rinpoche. You worked a lot with many teachers where you learned Tibetan medicine, and you've learned a lot of feng shui, many, many things. But these days, would it be fair to say that you're going forward with your commitment to carry out Drunpa Rinpoche's mandate by working both within the Shambhala Mandala as well as Khandra Rinpoche's Mandala? Would that be a fair way to present it?
I think that's very accurate. And, You know, it's funny because, I mean, I really feel at this point I'm at the end of my life. And watching the little pictures and video snippets that have thus far come out of the Blossoming of the Sun event, which was so wonderful. But watching that, you see a whole new generation, you know, manifesting this wonderful mandala, and realizing that, you know, as you actually get older, your roles and your activities and your proclivities change, and the way you manifest in the world changes, the way you manifest your practice changes.
How do you think that we within Shambhala versus perhaps your experience of other mandalas deal with this generation gap or generational difference?
I think in the Shambhala mandala, it's been a little bit of a rocky transition, mainly because our mandala is so large, and because there has been a passing of the torch, and I mean it takes time for these things to really, you know, for the tent pegs to really be driven in firmly again, and the mandala pulled together. So I think there has been a somewhat of a disjointed period of time between the generations. I think there's a great affection and appreciation, but we don't actually have the practical means for, I don't want to say make a generalized statement, but my own experience has been that it's been a little bit difficult to find your place and know your seat and you know, how to know how you can continue to function. Will you continue to function? Do you want to continue to, you know, and what does this all mean in the context of our mandala, different generations of practitioners?
Perhaps if it was difficult for us to even know how to work within Trungpa Rinpoche's world in relation to natural hierarchy, mm-hmm. I imagine it's even harder, and I've not just imagine, but experience it's even harder now that perhaps we have two sets of hierarchies that are actually operating at the same time, the older students of Trungpa Rinpoche and what could be considered the older students of Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche, in the sense that there are people who are very close to him, and in some ways they are the natural hierarchy of Trungpa Rinpoche's mandala, and we all are in the same space. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that's what we're kind of getting at, the two of us talking, is that it's they exist in parallel universes and at the same time, co-emergently, certain different kinds of hierarchical relationships.
Yeah, I think it's the space is the operative word here, or the natural part of the hierarchy, because, I mean, that's where these different, how to put this, that's the soil out of which these different flowers bloom. You know, I mean, you could look at each person as a natural hierarchy. I mean, that was the point of the Sakyong's last book. You can rule your world. And we do, and we aspire to do that ever better. And so, you know, what's the ground? It's the common ground that we have that will be our meeting place.
Okay.
You know, I feel. Otherwise, we're just looking at a lot of different structures. And there's no way for these, you know, for the machinery to, you know, it's like having a Mac and a PC, and none of your mouses work on, you know, what it's like.
You have been teaching Shambhala training. You have been teaching space awareness. You have also been working very, very closely with Khandra Rinpoche and her students. Can you talk a little bit about how you work with both Shambhala training and Khandra Rinpoche's teachings, and how does that work, that common ground?
It works for me because I found the ground is there. I mean, there is a common ground. That's kind of like full stop right there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's everything that Trungpa Rinpoche ever taught about waking up and being present and being genuine. I mean, that ground is there. And I mean, the flavor of his teachings from the very beginning had a very Dzogchen slant, and so, you know, having come full circle to the Dzogchen teachings today, of whether it's Khandru Rinpoche teaching or Kenpo Sultum Gyatso teaching and Sakyong teaching, these teachings, we're all, I think, on the same wavelength, and that's something to celebrate, I feel.
You are someone who studied a great deal about form, both physical form, language forms. How was the form of the universe that Khandru Rinpoche presented to you and the universe that Trungpa Rinpoche presented to you? What was the smell of the beef? Where's the beef here in terms of form? Because form is such an important part of your life, form and space.
Yeah, the whiff of connection for me came in a personal interview that I had with Khandru Rinpoche back in 1995. It was a very difficult time in my life. I was getting a divorce. I was very upset, and I had this interview, and I'll never forget it. We were in Marpa House in the suite, and I was sort of sitting on a low stool, and I was looking, and I was going on and on and on. And I remember my eyes kind of drifting up to the ceiling as I was relating all these things going on in my life. And all of a sudden, I hear this voice that just says, "Helen," and it calls me by my name. I mean, you know, this tone that was just unmistakably, I felt like a kitten whose mother cat had just gotten it by the scruff of the neck and just shaken it awake, you know, and just really given it a shake. It was so engaging. And so personal, and so much on the same wavelength as my experience of the Vidyadhara, that I felt like I was home. And of all the wonderful teachers and all the wonderful teachings that I had the pleasure and the honor to participate with and in, over the years, you know, it's that kind of a connection. It's a resonance, as we were talking about before. It's like love. It's a resonance. And, I mean, it's karmic on some level. It's
what year was this?
1995. Well, actually, that took place in 93.
In 93?
Or 94. Yeah.
So you have had, about 13 years now of time to observe how her Sangha has emerged. And I remember when she first started teaching in the West, how important it was for a number of women students to have a woman teacher. And I think that Pema, for example, has also experienced a great deal of giving some water to those who are thirsty for that specific kind of dharma, where gender identity was important. How has that played out in Khandru Rinpoche Sangha?
I think it was important to me, but it wasn't my criteria when I went looking for a teacher or a mother cat to take, you know, to pick me up by the scruff of the neck.
Could have been a tomcat.
Yeah, it could have been any kind of cat. you know, that thought was not in my mind, but it was important, and I do remember the last time. I think it was actually the last conversation I ever had with the Vidyadhara was. Feeling on some level, it was here in Halifax that it was going to be the last time I would see him, and blurting out, I don't know how this came out of my mouth, but you've got to come back as a woman, and you know, like the wish fulfilling gem that
he did in your case
that he continues to be that in fact happened, and it reminded me of an experience that took place at Naropa one time. Where I was, I dropped in on a poetry lecture. He was going to give a lecture on poetry, and it was the day after a Vajrayogini feast. And I wasn't a student at the time, and I wasn't teaching at the time. I was way in the back of this huge auditorium, and the Vidyadhara was being helped up the steps to a raised seat, and I was sort of irritated and hungry and tired, and I thought, well, you're supposed to see your teacher as the Yidam. So he's supposed to look like Vajrayogini. All this is going through my head. And all right, I'm looking at you as Vajrayogini, you know, I say to myself. And in mid-step, as he was ascending this throne, he turned around, looked all the way across the diagonal space to where I was standing, looked me straight in the eye, and just completely made a connection with me. And I was so shocked. I mean, I was just stopped in my tracks. So that was, you know, that was a very real experience. Gender irrelevance, and at the same time, the how personal it becomes. I feel that I've had, you know, some very powerful teachings by the Vidyadhara and also by Khandra Rinpoche on that issue.
And you have also been very fortunate to have been an editor of Khandra Rinpoche's books and Zigar Khandra Rinpoche's books and Pema's book. And I imagine you cannot edit their books unless you learn how to live both in the depth of their ocean as well as know how to surf their waves.
You might say that.
And be eaten by their whale, if not eaten by the barracudas. What do these different oceans feel like? It's kind of a strange question to ask, but I don't know even how one would actually describe Trungpa Rinpoche's ocean, except it was probably gorgeous and dangerous. And it probably was everything. But these days, for example, I've been spending some time working with Trungpa Rinpoche, and I sort of continuously think of him as Mr. Mahamudra. That though he teaches everything and he teaches very clearly, there seems to be a major thrust in his teaching, which is to understand Mahamudra and preserve it and make sure that those teachings are fully transmitted to a new generation. If one were to characterize your understanding, if it were possible at all, of working with Khandra Rinpoche and with Zigar Khandra or even with Pema, first thought, what would you say?
Well, first thought is there's no getting out of the Dorje Drodel's ocean. I mean, the ocean of Dharma is boundless, and so there is no limit to it. And I think we do ourselves a disservice when we put limits of concepts on the Great Eastern Sun or that ocean of Dharma, because it is boundless. And in that boundless ocean, there are just tremendous blessings. And Khandra Rinpoche and Zigar Khandra Rinpoche and Kenzi Rinpoche and all the great teachers, Pema and all these great teachers, you know, articulate these blessings. And so the way I see it, it's an amazing feast. And we would do ourselves such a disservice to in any way limit or constrict the celebration of feast, and at the same time, it brings out the incredible importance of form, you know, because when it is so boundless and so limitless, how do you speak of it? And you know, at one point, Trungpa Rinpoche said, "The Buddha's tongue is never numb," and I think this is why there was such an incredible emphasis in his Shambhala teachings on form. And this is, for me, a tremendous connection to the Mindro Ling lineage, which is known throughout history for exquisite form. And
how? Can you explain a little bit how?
The form of practice, form of chanting, form of music, monastic form. It was the first monastic discipline in Tibet was the Mindro Ling monastic tradition. It was the first monastic tradition. Sechen, Trungpa Rinpoche's root guru, Jamgon Khantrol of Sechen, the Sechen monastery was founded by, was a Mindro Ling monastery founded in the 16th century. So, there's a tremendous karmic connection, much of which I'm probably not even aware of. I'm certainly not a big history buff. And it would be really interesting to, I think, maybe request that Khandra Rinpoche speak to this when she's here in August.
She's coming to
explore this. She's coming to
Halifax.
Halifax, to
Dorje
Denmaling, to Gampo Abbey in August and early September.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And because I think this is it's just I mean, what negligence not to really
to inquire
but to also cultivate the wonderful ancestry and legacy that we do in fact share. It's quite powerful.
And Khanda Rinpoche has a nunnery in India because she is
a
nun.
Some can say.
But she also has a sort of lay center, so to speak, in Virginia. Is that correct?
She has a newly founded retreat center in Virginia called Lotus Garden. They have a website, but you have to say Lotus Gardens with an S, otherwise you get a Chinese restaurant.
It is karmic, isn't it?
LotusGardens.org or net, I forget which it is. But it's a wonderful retreat center, and she teaches an annual retreat there and has now begun a Shedra program, which Dzigchen Khantrol Rinpoche was kind enough to help initiate this year, along with Khanda Rinpoche.
And who has been teaching there besides Khanda Rinpoche and some of the traditional Tibetan teachers? You have been teaching at the center, Jan Jackson, Peter Lieberson.
Some of the older students, Peter Lieberson, Jan Jackson, myself, Rita Gross, and then people who may not be as, the Papantonios, Kathy and Andre, both of whom are well-known Shambhala, Baltimore Shambhala people. Have been teaching.
And
I think, you know, there's a beautiful interview that Khanda Rinpoche gave Fabrice Midal in his first book on Trungpa Rinpoche when asked what his major contribution was to the West. And she put it in an amazing, amazingly way. It's mandala, that he was the first teacher to come into the West to present Dharma in terms of mandala so that people could feel it was their life and not something outside of their life, that the Dharma was actually your life. Mm-hmm. And by expressing Dharma in terms of mandala, and the five Buddha family teachings, of course, are part of that, Khanda Rinpoche takes the same approach to establishing her mandala as well, the five Buddha families.
In terms of path, general outlines, you do have a sort of shamatha, vipassana component, and a nundra component, and a sadhana component.
Right.
And both Treksho Kantogo Ati forms, as well as the Mahamudra Kagyu forms, because she holds both lineages.
Yeah.
So it's a very complete path, very, very much emphasis on practice, is that correct?
And yes, and she's been really I don't know how else to put it, she's been downloading an amazing amount of traditional texts as well as teachings in all those areas, as well as, helping people to bring to fruition the practices that they've begun previously.
Yeah, downloading is an interesting word, because I do feel that many of the teachers these days are downloading and getting stuff written down and hoping that some tiny little part remains somewhere, and at some day when the right causes and conditions arise, somebody will get it, even if it is as simple as, you know, learning how to pour a cup of tea, as Trungpa Rinpoche used to say.
Right, right. And all the more reason, I think, for those of us who have studied with Trungpa Rinpoche to, you know, come back to that notion of holding your seat. I mean, the connection with the Mindroling Monastery and the discovery of the magnificent forms that lineage embodies reminds me so much of Lady Diana and her teachings on form and dressage. They're so pivotal to my personal ability to really just digest this richness, because, you know, it just gets down to that simplicity of knowing how to hold your seat. And so I'm very, very grateful to that and to her.
Good. You mentioned earlier that you had a sense that your life is short. There's short, and there's certainly less time left than yesterday. What would be your heart's desire in terms of the fruition of Dharma in the time you have left?
That ain't fair. Well, you know, an image comes to my mind, and it's the image of the first time I ever laid eyes on the Sakyong. It was in 1971 or 72, might have been 72. He was 9 years old. He had just come to the U.S. and was the car pulled up in front of what was then still Tale of the Tiger. And my little daughter was there, and I think at the time she was around, you know, 3 or 4. She was very small. And we had waited and waited for his arrival. It was interesting and exciting to people that Rinpoche's son was coming in. But we had been waiting for quite some time. And on the porch, there was a cat had given birth to a litter of kittens. And there was one of these little kittens, and my little tiny daughter had a bowl of milk and was trying to get this kitten to drink milk. And it was sticking this kitten's face in the milk over and over and over. And of course, you know, the kitty didn't want any. This all took place like within minutes. It's a very long-winded way of saying that the little Sakyong, who was then Ursul Mukpo, got out of the car, walked up the steps, saw this little, my daughter with this little kitten and milk all over its tiny little face, and took the kitten and put it on its mother's teat. And it was there was a simplicity and a naturalness. That to me is natural hierarchy. And that's what I aspire to. And that's what I aspire to for our Sangha.
Well, we have learned how to recognize where the beef is, and we know how to suckle.
Where
the milk is, and we know how to suckle, and we need the instruction on how to find it and stick to it. You were editing
Isaac
Kondo Rinpoche's
book. You know
book.
Isaac Dinesen?
Yeah. Out of Africa?
Yeah. I was Jim Lindsay had Fordrala bookstore. He had sent out a little notice, and it had the most wonderful quote, and I really wanted to include it, and I completely forgot. But it's a quote from her, and it is this: "Our longing is our pledge, and blessed are the homesick, for they shall come home." I love that. It's from The Diver, Anecdotes of Destiny.
Cat milk. Cat milk and beef smell again.
Cat milk and beef smell. Yeah, the Hell Realms were...
Oh, yeah, the Hell Realms. By the way, yeah.
More about the Hell Realms.
It's a travel show now.
Through the realms, as the mandala turns, as Lady Diana once said, sitting in the court in Boulder. When I was working, Kondra Rinpoche's book, This Precious Life, included the realms, and because it's on the four reminders. And so the hell realms are taught in a very traditional way and presented in a very traditional way, as one might find in Patro Rinpoche or whatever. The thing is, it was so traditional and so lengthy. The hell realms were like 5 or 6 times longer than any of the other realms, in addition to
particularly
being...
Particularly if you're there, it feels that way too.
Yes, it's even worse. And the descriptions were extremely evocative. And so I'm thinking, this is a trade book, you know. Maybe we could just lighten up on the hell realms a little bit or eliminate them. It was late. What was I thinking? I sent an email to Kondra Rinpoche asking if we could possibly
airbrush a little,
or at least shorten, so that we gave equal time to the various realms. And I got back in her usual completely gracious way: whatever you feel is appropriate, and it's up to you, and you know you're the one who knows. And completely gracious and kind and respectful and so on. And the last sentence: unless of course you would like people to learn something about Dharma. So it's sure, yeah, airbrush the hell realms, you know, unless you'd really like to tell the truth.
So I really want to thank you, and I really want to commend you on your discipline and everything that you have brought to all the people around you and to everyone in this show. and best regards to everyone in Khanda Rinpoche Sangha on behalf of Dispatches and the Chronicles Radio. Thank you, Helen.
It was my pleasure.
Adios.
Adios.
Thank you once again for listening to Chronicles Radio. This episode concludes our first season of Dispatches. We will return with our second season in September. In the meantime, the Chronicles of CTR will be posting new interviews in July and August. Please enjoy the rest of your summer. For now, this is Chronicles Radio, saying goodnight.
Rejoice the great Eastern Sun.